April 6, 2005. For the record, present are Representative McGuire, Coghill, Roachberg, Harris, and Coring. We have a quorum to do business. On today's calendar, we have HB 35, Extend Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors, and HB 197, Oil Spill Exemption for Gas Wells. With that, we'd like to take up House Bill 35. And Representative Coring, would you like to present this bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 35 extends the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors to 2009. It is going to expire in 2005. If we don't take action, then it goes into a sunset period where it will eventually be dissolved. And there seemed to be a compelling reason, based on the audit that was done by Legislative Budget and Audit, to extend this board. And I decided to file this bill on behalf of the organization here, several members of which I count as friends and colleagues, basically. So they convinced me that this was a bill that was warranted, in addition to the audit that I took a look at. Anyway, in the House Finance Committee, the organization had asked that the position called Landscape Architects be added as a voting member, full-fledged member of the board. So we added that person, bringing it up to 11 members from 10. However, since that time, they've convinced themselves that they would rather have the statute go back to how it was originally, to just 10 members, and not make the Landscape Architects as a full voting member of the organization. And they feel that there's not a substantial enough numbers of landscape architects in the state of Alaska at this point to warrant having that position a full-fledged voting member. So the organization is asking that we make that change to go back to how the statute currently is and to the original version of the legislation when it was first filed and approved by the passed out of the Labor and Commerce Committee. So that's what I'd like to do as the result of that presentation, Mr. Chairman, is to when the timing is appropriate, it would be to move an amendment here to make that modification to, again, remove the position of landscape architect as a full-fledged member of the board, and hence a voting member.
Ms. Representative Coring, our questions of the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, was that a...
Representative Harris.
Representative Coring, was that an offer for the amendment?
Well, no. If the chairman feels that's appropriate to make that amendment at this point, I'd be happy to move the amendment. But I'll wait for a direction from the chair.
Before we get into the discussion, help me with the discussion that led up to why they thought they should be put in first. So just to give me a context of
why it should go in to begin with. Mm-hmm. Well, I was hoping that we could have somebody here representing that organization to better explain that than I could, but apparently none of them are here. There were two individuals, but... It was felt that at the time when we had this bill in the Finance Committee that this industry, landscape architect industry, has evolved to the point where there's many people in that field, and it's a substantial industry now in the state of Alaska, and therefore they should be a player in this whole process here and have equivalent strength on this committee here as civil engineers, land surveyors, and mining engineers, et cetera, that are noted in the bill. Mm-hmm. But then there was a testimony that came forth, including Representative Holm himself, who's in this industry. He felt that they're not substantial enough in the industry to warrant making them a full player and therefore a full member of the committee and a voting member of that committee, that they're basically small potatoes, and therefore it's not warranted to have them in such a substantial position. I hope that helps.
Representative Coring, this is the chairman. I recollect somewhat the history of this, that there was a early on, a few years back, I don't know, 6 to 8 years ago, the landscape architects were added to the board. There was a substantial amount of controversy at that time. Mm-hmm. The legislature made the decision to allow them to sit at the board table but not have a voting right, allowing them to participate in the board activities to be regulated by the Division of Occupational Licensing. This has been an ongoing controversy for a number of years. Unfortunately, it seems as if we can't quite resolve it when we come to the extension of their sunset date, but if that's their desire, perhaps we can consider this further as it moves along, but I appreciate your desire to avoid any controversy. With that, I believe there's amendment that...
Yes, Mr. Mr. Chairman, if I may, I assume that we'll refer to this as amendment number one. And if I may speak to that, amendment
I'll object to it so you can speak to it.
Thank you very much. And I have a moved amendment, of course, just for technical purposes here. Anyway, there's nothing really more to say than what I've already said. It just removes the position of landscape architect from the legislation as far as that individual being a full voting member. I want to make it clear, though, that that individual is still a member of the board, as you had pointed out, Representative Roachberg, but as that individual will not be a full voting member. So that's what amendment number one does.
Representative Coring, why don't we do this? Instead of offering the amendment, why don't we just make a motion? Why don't you withdraw your motion and move to adopt the original A version of the bill?
Okay, we can do that. I would therefore ask to rescind amendment number one so that we could, rescind amendment number
withdraw.
One.
Withdraw amendment number one. And then let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Berkowitz. Representative Coring, you wish to make a motion to adopt version A, the original House bill?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
So we have a motion before us to adopt the House Bill 35, version A, 24LS0273. Is there any objections to adopting version A of the bill?
I want to object just to...
Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will remove my objection, but just to state on the record that I'd like somebody from the board to come by, if it's Amy Doherty or Sam Keto Jr., that's fine, but I want to hear a little bit more about it. I don't know the kinds of decisions that are made, but if I were a landscape architect and there were decisions being made about me with respect to the way I am forced to do my business or not do it, or fees that I might have to pay, I would want to be a voting member and, and be a part of that decision-making process. Sitting here today, out of respect for you as the sponsor of the bill, I will go ahead and withdraw my objection, but I would like to hear more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will make arrangements, thank you, sir, to have Amy Doherty or Sam Keto have a discussion with you in regard to that, but thank you very much for your consideration.
And Representative Coring, before we put this on the floor, I ask you to get a letter from the Professional Design Council indicating their concurrence, and that might allay any other fears or undue discussion that would be unnecessary.
Okay. Will do. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, also, I want to maintain the objection, too, for just a second here. I'd also like a letter from the Southern group saying they don't want to be on it either, or that they wouldn't oppose. I mean, I think that recommendation number three from the audit is pretty specific. The legislature should consider making the landscape architect representative to this committee a full voting member. So the audit was obviously raised some interest about it as well. So with that, I'll remove my objection as well.
Hearing no other objection, House Bill 35, original version with the individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, moves out of committee. Next, we'll take up House Bill 197, House Bill Exemptions for Gas Wells. Representative Coring's here.
Thank you.
Let's take a brief at ease.
Get the book. You never had a motion to move it out of committee, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, yes, we did.
Version of House Bill 35 out of committee with individual recommendations and any fiscal notes that may be involved.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Now we'll pick up House Bill 197. Representative Coring.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 197 is a bill that the administration was going to put forth, the Oil and Gas Committee produced the legislation, but it's one that's supported by the administration and the oil and gas industry. And what it does is it provides a exemption to what are called oil spill contingency plans, or C plans for short, for natural gas facilities, for exploration or development facilities. It exempts those operations from having to put forth C plans, which can be expensive and time-consuming, involving paperwork and so forth. When it comes to drilling for natural gas where there's no potential for oil to be found, if there's not going to be any potential for oil to be found and therefore a potential for oil spill, say if they're drilling for gas and the oil were to rise to the surface and spill out on that surface, there's no point in having an oil spill contingency plan. And there's no point in having the company put forth that plan and incur the costs associated with that. So this provides an exemption to that. However, there was some concern in the Resources Committee that there needed to be a greater clarity in the legislation, in the language of the legislation, to make sure that we were focusing just on facilities that and exploration facilities that relate to just natural gas. So on page 3, there's some new language that is the result of a CS that you have before you. This is actually not an amendment I'm going to be proposing, but it's in the form of a CS.
Representative Carney,
it's a clarification language.
Right. You want to go ahead and move the committee substitute so we have it before us then?
Having explained that, hopefully that's a good explanation. If not, I have Larry Dietrich and Ben Brown here from the various agencies that are affected by this legislation to further explain what I'm trying to accomplish here. But with that, I'd like to move the CS for House Bill 197.
No object.
What version?
It's the Y version. I hear the chairman hears a slight peep of an objection.
More than a slight peep, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, well, with that,
I want to.
Chair recognizes an objection, and Representative Harris, you want to speak to your objection?
Well, Larry's back there. Maybe I could get him. The sponsor of the CS, I know, has said what it is, but I'd like to get just a little more in-depth. The Resources Committee must have done some work on this, and I just want to.
Just for a point of clarification, Representative Coring. We heard the original version in oil and gas. Then it went to the Resources Committee, and they adopted the F version. Are you defaulting back to the Y version, or is there, the original version, or what?
No, we're including the Resources version as far as the language in that version, but we're adding an additional point of clarification, which is on page 3, lines 14 and 15. And I'd like to defer to Larry to offer an explanation on that, if I could, please.
Yes. We do have here four questions, Mr. Dietrich, and also Ben Brown from DEC for everybody's information. Mr. Dietrich, for the record, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Questions, Representative Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Larry, the sponsor of this CS has said that there's only a change in Section 4, I guess. Can you go over all the changes from the resource version to the Y version, this work draft that we have in front of us here, the CS?
Through the chair, yes, I'll make an attempt at doing that. The original version was amended.
Now, I don't want you to go back to the original version.
Okay.
I want you to go from the resource version.
Okay, from the resource version. The amendment that's shown on page 3 would be line 13, okay, where it says crude oil does not include natural gas, was amended that originally included the terminology that included refined petroleum products, and that was deleted in the last amendment. And when we had law take a look at that, when that amendment was made, that definition for crude oil is also used in line 20. Okay? And so when you take refined petroleum products out of the definition, out of that definition, it has the effect when it is used in line 20 of basically lowering the threshold for when oil terminals would have to get a contingency plan from the current 10,000 barrels to really any amount. and that's not the intent of the bill. So what has been done in the committee substitute now is there's a substitute section in here that captures that eliminates both of those definitions and makes it much more clear now that that will not happen, that the exemption only applies to natural gas facilities.
So no crude oil facility, this piece of legislation is not effective to any crude oil facility?
That's correct. And I think I think they've done a good job with the Y substitute to making it clear under Section 4, and the committee substitute that Representative Corey introduced makes that very clear now, beginning on line 9. What they've essentially done is eliminating those confusing definitions for crude oil and refined natural gas, and it's much clearer now in the committee substitute, particularly on line 14. It says, mean a platform, facility, or structure that except for storage of refined petroleum products in a quantity that does not exceed 10,000 barrels. So the exemptions, as they are as currently provided in this bill, only applies to natural gas.
Can you give me a description of a 10,000-barrel refinery in Alaska?
The definition is for an oil terminal, and the threshold for requiring a contingency plan for oil terminals is that the combined storage at the oil terminal is over 10,000 barrels. That's 420,000 gallons. So those are large facilities. They essentially would not cover most of the smaller facilities in rural Alaska as a threshold. It's a pretty sizable volume.
So the $10,000 bright line is currently in law now?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And this is primarily intended for any facility that has refined products for its use on its site. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It's like in situ consumption.
Well, that's what that's the problem they're trying to avoid here. Before, when they made that change in the previous edition, what it would have done is it would have effectively lowered that threshold from 10,000 barrels for any amount, okay, and therefore you would have had to get a contingency plan, and I don't think that was the intent. That's certainly not our intent. That means probably 200 additional facilities in the state would be required to have contingency plans. And that was never the intent going into this bill at all. The intent was simply to make it clear that natural gas facilities would, and those alone, would not be required to have a contingency plan. Those are gas-only type facilities.
Right. Mr. Trickett, my recollection from testimony in the Oil and Gas Committee, this legislation is primarily targeted or intended to speak to the reinjection primarily, or is there other provisions of the bill? Is my memory faulty on this? Are we injecting so-called toxic materials?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that may have been a testimony associated with the bill for underground injection control. They heard that at the same meeting, I believe, and so this would not deal with the injection at all.
Wrong bill.
Yeah.
I'm glad I asked. Any further questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berkowitz.
I know you use 10,000 barrels for non-crude in other portions of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of curious what the break point is for the number of platforms, facilities, or structures that are impacted by increasing it to 10,000 as opposed to, say, 5,000.
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, the statutes currently require that for oil terminals with a storage volume of over 5,000 barrels of crude are required to have a contingency plan, and then 10,000 barrels for non-crude. So this does not change that at all. Those thresholds remain the same.
If I can follow up, maybe I'm not understanding what's going on here, but it seems to me if you have natural gas production facilities that are currently required to have contingency plans, which I think doesn't make a lot of sense just for the natural gas production. But if they've got 10,000 barrels on site, how many facilities are we talking about?
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, if I understand your question, so how many facilities where we have a natural gas drilling, exploration, or production for natural gas that also are an oil terminal and storing refined products over 10,000 barrels?
What I want to know is how many facilities are impacted by this change to the statute?
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, I don't think this will impact any existing facilities. What this does is it ensures that gas drilling in the future, okay, that does not encounter oil, as may be determined by AOGCC, are not required to have contingency plans unless they are also storing refined products over 10,000 barrels.
In my experience, I've moved barrels, and 10,000 mm-hmm. barrels is a lot of barrels.
Yes.
It would just seem to me that with 10,000 barrels, there should be some kind of, I don't care what you are, I mean, there's got to be some kind of spill plan for 10,000 barrels.
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, that's correct. If you're a facility and you have over 10,000 barrels, you have to have a contingency plan now. And under this change, you will continue to have a contingency plan. But
if you had 5,000 barrels, you wouldn't require one.
That's correct.
And that's still a lot of oil.
That's correct.
And Mr. Kier, how would this affect, say, a Cook Inlet gas platform right now? Would that have any impact on that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it would have any effect on those at all. What it would really apply to is future drilling for gas. What it does is it clarifies that if you are drilling for gas, and upon a review and evaluation by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, they determine that there's no oil that will be associated with that drilling, then you will not have to have a contingency plan. If they determine that oil is likely to be encountered during that drilling, such that when you flow that well, it will include gas and oil, then you will have to have a contingency plan. So it's really targets probably the non-conventional gas and clarify gas type wells to clarify that where oil will not be encountered, you do not have to have a contingency plan.
Well, Mr. Deaker, would you assume that a gas production platform at Cook Inlet would have less than the 10,000 barrels of refined product on it?
Mr. Chairman, I think most of the platforms in the inlet probably do have less than 10,000 barrels, yes.
Your testimony, this only applies to the permitting process by the AOGCC? I'm trying to recall this bill.
Mr. Chairman, what happens is when an operator applies to drill a permit, they have to get a permit to drill from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And if upon review of their proposal, they determine then that if it's a proposed gas well, they will review it. And upon their review of the reservoir and other technical information, they determine that no oil will be encountered, then they would not have to have a contingency plan for the drilling of that well. Now, if that well was being drilled for crude oil, or if AOGCC determines they'll encounter crude oil, then they would have to have a contingency plan.
What if it's a wildcat or frontier exploration? I mean, most drillers I know are E&P mm-hmm. companies like to hit oil.
That's right.
You know, maybe even serendipitously. You know, so what happens then if it typically on a rank area, they're only looking at seismic data when they're getting permits, or do they have to offer seismic data when they make their permitting?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's the review that's done by Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and our department does not have the technical expertise to make those determinations, which is why we rely on AOGCC to do that. They have reservoir engineers and the technical capability so that when they make the review, they make the assessment whether or not oil will be present. And they have testified earlier. I cannot think of a case where they've missed the mark to date on that. The question also came up that, well, what if they did miss the mark and oil was encountered? Would a plan still be required? And the answer is yes, it would. Yeah. Granted, it would be a little bit later in the process because normally they're required to have before you start drilling, but an operator is still otherwise required to immediately contain, control, and remove the oil. And they would still be required at that point in time then to prepare a contingency plan, submit it for review and approval.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Berkowitz.
You know, some of one of the things I want to do is I want to get a paint locker, the house, put all my paint in it. It's one of the things I've learned about dealing with these kind of materials is you need some kind of containment plan. And I'm not sure whether if you remove the strictures of a full-blown contingency plan, there's still some kind of oversight for someone who's got, say, 9,000 barrels on site. Maybe you could clue me in on that.
Yes, Representative Berkowitz, through the chair. Currently, yeah, the statutes define the regulatory the threshold at which facilities have to have contingency plans, and they're defined for exploration and gas facilities, for pipelines, for the railroad, for tank vessels, oil barges, and oil terminals. Mm-hmm. And in the case of oil terminals, it's these thresholds we've been talking about here. So if it's a refined product, it's a 10,000 barrel threshold. The idea of a contingency plan is that if you're above that threshold, okay, then you have to take steps to prepare a plan so there's certainty that you've got the resources, equipment available to be able to respond to contain the response planning standard for that kind of facility. If you're below that threshold, you are not required to take those steps for preparedness. So there is no contingency plan required for whatever is below the threshold for any of those facilities.
Is there any treatment plan required? Does this stuff have to be bermed? Does it have to be stored in a certain way? Is there anything?
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, the only other regulatory requirement that might be come in would be there's an EPA spill prevention, containment, and countermeasure plans, which imposes some requirements. And so at the federal level, your proposed facility that you're suggesting here may or may not, it depends on the situation there, but it may or may not be required to have that federal plan.
So, okay, Mr. Chair, so there's some federal requirements then for less than 10,000 barrels?
Representative Berkowitz, that's correct.
And what's the federal threshold?
The federal threshold, I believe, is for a smaller tank volume size, and it basically requires that a plan be prepared and signed off by a registered engineer for containment control, but it's not otherwise required to be submitted to them for review and approval. So it requires that they have one at the facility.
Representative Coghill. Oh, excuse me, are you done?
Oh, and it'd be prepared by a qualified person. That's the intent.
Yeah, and I'm kind of going in that same direction because I can remember setting up small fuel facilities where we had anywhere from 500 to 5,000 gallon capacity, and we had to set up containment barriers. Mm-hmm. We had to even sign off on some action plan for spill. So it seemed to me like there was some regulation both on the state side and on the federal side. And am I wrong?
Represent
all that for nothing?
No.
Well, Representative Coghill, through the chair, yeah. And from a state perspective, from a Title 46 perspective, unless you're below this threshold, no, you're not required to do it. The federal EPA SBCC plans do apply and would require that you have the secondary containment. And indeed, depending on where the facility was in any given situation, it's not uncommon for oil, gas, lease sales, or other operators using state or federal lands to have requirements similar to that imposed as land use stipulations to their operation being conducted on public lands. So it may have been either one of those, perhaps, that was in play at that time.
Mr. Dietrich, or even the bill sponsor, I'm refreshing my memory on this legislation, although I may not have been in the committee when it was heard. It's caused my lack of knowledge or understanding or recall. Is not the purpose of this bill to correct a situation where when legislation was recently passed on the whole non-conventional gas well legislation that mm-hmm. there was an inadvertent or error made in defining what these plans apply to, and just basically this bill returns us to fundamentally the status quo prior to that bill?
That is correct.
And that's what we're doing here is merely changing that, and that historically or previously we didn't have this requirement, and that's what we're trying to go back to because this is basically correcting an unintended consequence. And I would venture to say I believe, and I wish somebody was here from from Doug or Division Oil and Gas to mention this, or even the AOGCC, but the AOGCC has responsibility if it's a type of well or formation that there is any suspicion that oil would be encountered, that they would typically require a plan. But if it's a non-conventional shallow gas well or something like that, I just talked to the chaps from Red Dog yesterday where they're drilling in a shale formation where it would be almost geologically certainty that there wouldn't be any crude encounter. So therefore, they wouldn't require a plan. I think that's what this is intended to do. Is that correct, Mr. Duggan?
Mr. Chairman, that was that's precisely the case. That was very accurate. It returns us. There was never any intent to change any of these other thresholds for any other facilities. And it's true that the prior bill did create confusion, and it suggested for those gas wells you might have to have a C plan. So the intent of the fix was simply to clarify that if you're a pure gas well, no C plan is required, and that's what this bill does. And it does not in any way, shape, or form adjust any of the other thresholds.
So we're not breaking new ground here in terms of environmental protection?
It does. It returns it back to exactly the way it was before HB 531 kind of created the issue.
So if I want to put 10,000 barrels in the backyard, that's okay?
Yeah, if it's over 10,000, though, you'll need a C plan.
9,900.
Right.
And that, there's no requirements that I do anything with it aside from the federal requirements.
Representative Berkowitz, through the chair, that's correct from a state standard. When you go back through Alaska statutes, the thresholds that the state set, they were looking to require preparedness and contingency planning at our large facilities. And so when those original thresholds were set, and they're sprinkled back down back through the 80s, actually the first C-plan requirements came back on in the 70s, and it was targeting the pipeline and big-time crude oil production. So the thresholds were set high, really, for Alaska because the legislatures that passed those laws were worried about big spills. And so they targeted big facilities as a general rule. And to date, they have not opted to go into smaller facilities and put those burdens on the smaller operators in the state.
Right. Sounds like I should get my own strategic petroleum reserve in the backyard.
Well, Mr. Tetrigar, I know there's local ordinances, but for example, does your department look at filling stations, petroleum service stations for the large? We had this whole debate for years. I mean, how many gallons are in a typical service station? Don't you regulate those?
Mr. Chairman, there was in 1988, the EPA passed, again, federal legislation requiring the removal of underground storage tanks over, I believe, at 660 gallons, and those were largely the ones that are associated with service stations. There was a 10-year time frame created that ended in 1998, then, where all leaky underground storage tanks had to be upgraded, removed, or pulled. The Alaska legislature passed a financial assistance program recognizing that burden, and we've come to the end of that in 1998. There originally was some 7,000 underground storage tanks that were subject to those federal requirements in 88. About 6,000 now have been removed, upgraded, or closed in the state and are now in compliance with federal rules.
Tens of thousands of more of residential diesel fuel or other fuel tanks have been dug up because of that, because of real estate disclosure and other protections. Let's see. Representative McGuire.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I've noticed over the years is you come in to try to correct a little part of a statute, and you end up bringing attention to the underlying statute, and I think it's a good thing. It forces the legislature, even when we're not seeking to make fundamental policy change, to reflect on decisions that have been made. And I think the discussion's been interesting. I would just be curious to know if there have been any spills documented below the 10,000 barrel threshold. That's question number one. And number two, is there any reflection that occurs from year to year within your department as to whether or not we do need, and maybe it's not the full C plan, maybe it's for 5,000 barrels and less, it's some type of modified contingency plan that would be, you know, less onerous. I understand the cost, I understand the reason for the 10,000 barrel threshold. That being said, I'd like to know whether there have been any spills in the lower levels, and then whether you think there's any need to reflect on.
Yes, Representative McGuire, through the chair. With regard to whether or not there are any spills below 10,000 barrel from facilities that store less than 10,000 barrels, the answer is yes. The predominant number of spills reported in the state are from smaller facilities. We receive approximately 2,000 spill reports a year. We've done numbers on those facilities that are regulated and are required to have state contingency plans. There's been over time, recent years here, about a five-year period, approximately a 33% reduction in the number of spills from the facilities that have contingency plan. And I think that's a credit to the operators, the large operators. They've been doing a much better job, and the actual number of spills from those larger facilities is down dramatically. A lot of our spills, the bulk of them, are smaller spills from facilities that are not required to have those contingency plans. Now, is there something we need to do there? I mean, if you want to look at those smaller facilities, and there are these other requirements that these facilities become subject to, the leaky underground storage tank, land use stipulations, EPA SPCC rules can be applied to those facilities. And one I didn't mention that frequently affects how smaller facilities are designed or operated are the fire prevention rules, so that frequently they will drive where you can put a fuel tank, whether or not it needs to be contained, et cetera. So it's not that they're totally without regulation. They do get exposed to those other requirements. And, you know, it is a policy call, I think, on the part of the state as to whether or not you want to lower that contingency plan regulation or have some intermediate kind of plan that's less rigorous than the plan for our big facilities. We haven't considered that in the last couple of years.
Representative McGuire.
And then just finally, I'd be interested just to continue the discussion, but I think the figure that you just cited, 33% of those that have been required to file a contingency, there's been a 33% reduction in oil spills on the part of those who are required to file a contingency plan. That tells me that some part of that's working. And maybe it's the educational process, maybe it's making employees aware, maybe it's the fact that, you know, accidents happen. And when they do, you know, we want to know sort of what we're going to do to contain it. But I think I'd like to continue the discussion. I'm not interested in making lives more difficult for some of the folks out there that that have these smaller numbers of barrels. That being said, I think, at least from her testimony, filing these plans has led to a reduction, number one. And number two, my concern, the leaky underground storage tank rules and so on, they really deal with where you place it and how you can or can't place it. But then what I'm more concerned about is what happens when there's a spill, and how do you contain that? How do you act quickly to have the least impact on the environment? And so...
Representative McGuire, through the chair, yeah, those cases where an operator has a spill but does not have a contingency plan, what is the statutory framework that applies? And the legislature, over the years, there are separate statutes that impose responsibility on any operator at any facility that has a spill to, quote, immediately contain, control, and remove that spill. Now, granted, they may not have a contingency plan, but the underlying burden and responsibility and liability is set forth in separate statutes, so that applies across the board. The other measures that have been taken for those kinds of situations is the adoption in the early 90s of this incident command system, okay? So for those cases where you may not have indeed a contingency plan in place, the fact of the matter is that's where the Coast Guard, the EPA, and the state has ramped up. We have incident management teams now, and there is capability in the state through that in our spill co-ops, our spill cooperatives, which we have five in the state now, that even if you do not have a contingency plan, the capability to immediately respond and assist that operator is there. The legislature has also established the $50 million spill response account as a cash reserve that can be used to assist in those kinds of situations. So there is capability. We've substantially beefed up and reinforced the capability for those situations you're talking about, so that the government can step in and augment as may be needed. The spiller is still financially responsible. We still do cost recovery. But to the extent he's not immediately ready to do it, we have spill plans in place to cover those gaps.
Mr. Dietrich, for example, in our many villages have fuel storage farms mm-hmm. and storage facilities throughout the state, particularly in rural areas where they have to store their power generation and heating fuel. Are there requirements for spills, contingency plans for that type of storage?
Mr. Chairman, the primary plan probably that applies for the facilities you're talking about would be the EPA Spill Prevention Containment and Countermeasures Plan. Most of those facilities in rural Alaska are below the thresholds set by the state for facilities. Most of them are below the 10,000 barrel mark. And indeed, Alaska Energy Authority, which is doing a lot of the rebuilds for the Denali Commission, they particularly look at those volumes and those regulatory thresholds in the design because it affects the operational cost. So they're actually doing designs so that you can design around the 420,000 barrel, to avoid the additional costs that come. The contingency plans and those additional preparedness are not without costs. There's a cost component to that. And I think that's probably why historically the legislature set those thresholds where they were, because the preparedness cost element, it varies with facility, but it's a real cost to doing business.
And does not your department enforce EPA standards when they're in the normal everyday activities with further backup from the EPA?
Mr. Chairman, the SPCC plan is not one of the federal programs that's been delegated to the department, so no, we do not. EPA does periodically hire a contractor to actually go out and check facilities to make sure they have SPCC plans and the things that are required by those plans. So they have periodically checked in the state in recent years.
Representative Harris.
Larry, though, most of the seemingly that when I've been out to rural Alaska and seen new tank farms or new facilities, they're either some sort of double wall tanks or they're in placed inside of some sort of a containment initially. They may not have a contingency plan if the spill were to occur, you know, but they right. have some sort of a contingency plan built in initially when containment, whatever, that if there's a leak or if there's some sort of a spill involved with that, that it catches it, attempts to catch it, so you can actually deal with sucking it up or doing whatever you have to do to clean it up.
Right. Representative Harris, through the chair, that's correct. Virtually all new facilities are being built to new standards now, so even the ones that the Denali Commission is working on is being built to standards now that require secondary containment in the normal course of events. There's corrosion control, leak detection, welding requirements, all kinds of specifications now that new facilities are built to. Even the underground storage tanks are all built now to new standards, the idea being we don't want to put tanks back in the ground after removing roughly 6,000, you know, that just recreate the same problem. So they have both design requirements and monitoring and inspection now that service station operators have to carry out, all to ensure they don't leak.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks. I make an observation that I've got to go to a caucus, but Representative McGuire is right. You come into these meetings with one set of information on your mind and you learn something else. And it seems to me that we ought to be a little bit concerned that we've let the federal government fill the field on regulations for these smaller facilities or smaller barrel requirements. And I think it ought to be something we think about asserting some state primacy over, to the extent that we can.
Mr. Dietrich, what is the cost of developing a C-plan, contingency spill plan?
Mr. Chairman, again, that depends on the size and the complexity of the facility, and over time, particularly for our oil and gas drilling, we've tended towards having umbrella plans so that you can get more wells under a single facility. Typically, it's probably $5,000 maybe to get a consultant to put one together. But what comes with that then, that's beyond just the preparation costs, then are the operational things, the inspection things that go with that then that are also an ongoing operating cost.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coggio.
I know we talked about everything from underground storage tanks now up to the larger facilities that are going to be drilling. In those storage facilities, those are mostly terminals. They're, mm-hmm. They're places where you are storing them for use. And I can tell you, just as somebody who's been around it enough, that usually they're near water, so that means you mm-hmm. have the Corps of Engineers there. You certainly have federal oversight on EPA. You have the fire safety issues. And having been one that's had to fill out several reams of paper saying that we have static this and containment barriers there, and I can tell you that the storage facilities, and I suppose when we reach that 10,000 limit, we're talking about some huge oil spill issues mm-hmm. that would require multiple agencies' coordination, where on the other one, you probably don't have that same kind of coordination effort. So I guess the question I would get to then is, what type of facility under 10,000 barrels that's drilling for gas would anticipate keeping a storage anywhere near 10,000 barrels on a continuing basis?
Representative Coggio, through the chair. Yeah, for oil and gas drilling, it would be the exception where you would have a gas drilling operation that would also have on-site storage in excess of 10,000 barrels. I mean, you're basically talking about refined products and stuff associated with the drilling operation to run diesel generators and that kind of thing. So, yeah, are there cases where an operation may have storage in excess of that associated with an exploratory drilling operation? Probably not. There may be some exception, but I can't think of one.
Mr. Chairman, I would just only submit that you might want to allow them, if there's a small pool that they might have to deal with immediately, I wouldn't anticipate that if they're going after the gas that they would have the storage even then. They would probably try to move it out somehow in some kind of a mobile way.
So pipeline.
They wouldn't have that on storage. And so I think that that's a pretty good size limit for these drilling.
Well, with that, I just would like to wrap up as a commercial real estate broker and as a member of the Alaskan business community. I must say that I don't believe that we are short on enforcing spill cleanups, the requirements for both federally and at the state level for the conduct of business. And I believe the intention of our statutes now is not to put undue burdens, but to make sure that large project activities are duly permitted. And reflecting back to what Representative Corrig has indicated, the nature of this bill is that we're not really breaking any new ground here. So with that, any further discussion? Representative Coggio.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move out House Bill 197, version Y, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And with that, the Rules Committee is adjourned at 9:27.
Good meeting.
Thank you, members of the committee.